Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Prison Justice Show. Last time, we finished up our brief review on how COVID-19 in prisons has developed, basically what has happened so far and what is happening in this second wave. We found that the new wave had reached a peak of new daily cases that was even higher than the first one, even higher than the previous one, I should say, which was disconcerting when considering that prison officials had a whole first wave to see what measures they should implement. But despite that, they didn't really seem to have done anything. Furthermore, we found that overall outcomes in prisons were much worse than in the general population, with the adjusted death rate for those imprisoned being 3 times higher for those incarcerated and infected than those who were just in the general population. We also saw that from an epidemiological standpoint, it just made plain sense to reduce the prison population in general, because these are locations where we could actually make a bunch of changes to do so, and there are many safe ways to do so. So this is what I mean by this is there's lots of measures that people always recommend in these situations, and some of them are just measures that are really out there. You know, like if you said something like, "Oh, we should release everyone," then that's, you know, I don't think most people would agree with that. Whether or not you believe it's a good thing to do so, I don't think most people would agree with that. But I'm saying that there are a lot of really safe options that these organizations have given to actually reduce the prison population during this time period, and a lot of like just really common sense things. And this is especially because jails and prisons end up as amplifiers of the virus that then spread back to the general community, and in doing so cause even further outbreaks in people who aren't incarcerated. So even if you are someone that says, "Oh, I don't care about them at all," well, you should, just from a community standpoint as well. And this is especially true in the case of jails, where people would be held for a few days before trial because you have a lot of people moving in and out of these areas, which not only increases up the chances of someone infected, you know, going in there, obviously, but also increases just the just how much this thing is going to spread. You know, we saw some strategies on how to do so in particular from the Prison Policy Institute, which included things like changing parole requirements and eligibility, changing sentencing, and even changing how or if trials are conducted. And finally, we saw that even though these recommendations were well thought out, the policy drivers just weren't there, meaning that we didn't see many people in power actually making any changes that reflected these concerns. And seeing as how the second wave has already been worse than the first in terms of the daily case statistic, it seems that they should be taken more seriously. But with that as our recap of last time, let's look at our topic for today, which is something a little bit less dire, but maybe just as dire if we look deeply at it. And this is prison poetry. It's probably the only kind of thing that I can say something like a bit less dire, but maybe even more, and not just be patting myself on the back for saying something as odd as that. So most people have probably heard about prison poetry in some way or another. You know, it's a way for incarcerated people to express themselves and their experience in a productive manner. You know, it's a way to work through and recognize their feelings. But I think that this is kind of a simplistic view of it that I'm giving here, talking about it as a way to blow off steam. And in doing so, I don't think that I give it enough credit here. So sure, it can be used just for that, and there's nothing wrong with doing so, but more realistically, it's a way for incarcerated people to develop their thoughts in a complex manner. You know, prison poetry often shows a deeper reflection into many subjects, you know, the meaning of innocence versus guilt, the exploitation of a punitive system that steals monetarily, mentally, and spiritually from those it has deemed stole from society. You know, the loss of connections to loved ones on the outside, you know, the feelings of being forgotten. These are just a few that I can name in just a couple of short poems that I browsed through. But it's not just about depression and agony, of course. You know, some do talk about those that they care about and those that they just can't get back to soon enough. But rather than hear me talk about it, we can read some of those poems that they've written. So to begin with, we have a poem from Carlos Brown. So Carlos Brown wrote the following at Kettle Moraine Correctional Institute with the title of DEPEN, or Public Enemy Napalm. Pimp your pain. Lay blame at the feet of the world. This debt owed to be paid to the society. Judiciary prejudice as punitive restitution. Exploit your grief. A thief sanctimonious of some lost and pilfered pearl. Serrated tears blindly trickle to anoint the sanguinary. As woe-stained hands exchange compensatory currency, whore your hurt. Insert and excerpt reciprocal gumdrops of seditious copulation. Cram your oral and emotional sinkholes with deviled eggs, spilling the seeds of hatred from a bitter-spread eagle, dispersing a like wound for a like wounded earth's remuneration. Public enemy napalm. Under strict orders to hold court in this ink, the pen renders judgment from cipher. Who's right? Who's wrong? Who thought to think this pen silent? I write in leftist tones, attesting to the rights of lifers. Witness the victim's surcharge. I pen unpenitent sentences. Explosively, I write an inflammatory discharge. Wronged, I write, if you can read remote detonated ink blots. Their plot to bury me alive in cement blocks with no MR. Before the storm, beware the calm. Public enemy, napalm. Carlos Sundiata Ibn Islam Brown. And this piece is a great example of what I'm trying to explain in many of these episodes, but can't really get at the heart of because I haven't been incarcerated myself. And it's this feeling of exploitation, not only of your body, but of your mind as well. And in terms of exploitation of your body, it's much more explicit and deep than you might expect as well. You know, involuntary labor, read as slavery, in prison isn't just some work that you do to pay for your crimes, you know, whatever that might mean. It is to be pimped for pain, you know, to receive some compensatory currency as you whore your heart every day and try to plug up the holes in yourself that seem to keep popping up as a malicious attitude towards the world seems to keep seeping out of these holes despite your best attempts due to the situation you're in. And you really get this imagery of someone who feels like he doesn't have ownership of himself at all anymore. You know, they feel like a prostitute, like they're being prostituted for these things. And again, remember that we're not talking about whether that is a profession is a good thing or not. It's just about the baggage that comes with thinking of yourself as such and the baggage that comes with those terms. And if you're someone who's ascribing those terms to yourself, remember that we're trying to keep in mind how this makes him feel. And, you know, who wouldn't begin to hate a world then that forced them to pimp and whore themselves? Again, remember, it's not about the words themselves. It's about the fact that this is a person who's ascribing to themselves these terms, along with all the baggage that they carry. And yet the way that they find that they can fight back against the system that does all these horrible things to them is not by rendering unto it, which it has to them. The validity of that is a separate issue, which I'm obviously woefully unequipped to handle. And what I mean by that is just it's not to do violence to a system that committed violence to them, but to, quote, pen unpenitent sentences, to write an inflammatory discharge, to have their writing themselves become public enemy napalm. And perhaps through this writing, they're able to fill the holes that they find seeping hatred out of their bodies. Maybe they're able to find a way to plug up their oral and emotional sinkholes with something that's, you know, not just cramming something in there like deviled eggs, as he said. You know, maybe they're able to find a way to stop themselves from spilling the seeds of hatred out. Maybe they're able to become napalm without actually setting anything on fire. So you can see not only is there a pretty deep understanding of the kind of like hurt and exploitation that's happened to them, but there's also an understanding that the way to respond to the kind of violence and things that have happened to them isn't to do so with violence in and of itself. And I think that's a pretty interesting take that that Carlos had in this poem. So as an aside here, people tend to have this idea, or perhaps this is only in my experience with people, which, you know, might just be my bad luck, but they tend to have this idea that incarcerated people are less intelligent for some reason or another, and that this is what led to their situation. But even easily searchable examples like Brown's poetry puts that idea to rest pretty cleanly. You know, like, he puts into clear, understandable words a horrendous situation that I could never come close to explaining. Like, if I myself had thought, like, oh, I'm going to write a poem about my experience, I could never come close to what he wrote there. And so I think that it's really interesting, just kind of the big difference between how people who are incarcerated are perceived to be and, you know, the reality, which is that they do have, like, pretty deep thoughts about their situations and, you know, why they're in there, both in like a direct cause and effect case and, you know, just in general in a more systemic view. As promised, though, not everything is despair, although these are important aspects to understanding the prison experience as well. So the same author, Carlos Brown, wrote another poem called Gloriana. And it goes as such. The eyes of Gloriana look deep into my soul to research my intentions. She finds that I only intend to love her, Gloriana the beautiful. She was born of the beatific, and I was blessed to be in the presence of her beauty. My arms were her cradle, my heart was her lullaby. As she lay there, lost in my blackness, we met in silent battle. With equally inquisitive stares of wonder, in this we could not foul, to succumb to one another. And there was no wound more fatal than our goodbye. But I have lived on, thrived on the memory of holding Gloriana in my arms. Now this poem isn't sunshine and rays either, but it definitely comes from a much more positive place than the original one. And it goes to show as well that incarcerated people aren't just one aspect of themselves. You know, here Brown talks about someone that they remembered holding in their arms, you know, whose memory they hold dear to their hearts and whose memory they actually use as a driving force to get through their experience as well. And remember, this is the same person who wrote the first poem. It's the same person who felt like he was whored and pimped out. So Brown is not only someone who experiences being exploited, you know. They're also someone who has memories of people that they loved deeply before and continued to love during their incarceration. And so on another random tangent, I think that this multifaceted aspect is what a lot of displays of prison poetry actually end up missing out on. It's like we've all seen displays of prison poetry at some event or another. You know, maybe you remember seeing them at school. I remember, like, we had some in elementary school. We saw some in, like, middle school, high school. Maybe you saw them at a fair or something when you were walking around. And, you know, there's always a bunch of different places to see these things. Maybe you just read them online, you know, the way that I just did. But I don't know that many of these displays actually have multiple pieces from the same author. And if they do, I don't know if people really read these multiple pieces and make the connection that it's actually the same person writing completely thematically different pieces. You know, most of the time, when you look at these things, you just read a piece here, you skip a few pages, you read a piece there, but you may not make the connection that it's the same people writing these things. Even if you don't have the same person multiple pieces in the same poetry book, I think that it's also easily appreciable that the different ideas presented in the book could all be ascribed to the same person. And so when you see, like, a poem about the prison experience and you see that it's overly, you know, depressing or scary, and you see another one and you see that, you know, they're hopeful, they're looking towards the future, recognize that these aren't necessarily, like, two separate experiences. You can have this same people with these very varied and diverse thoughts the same way that you can have them on the outside as well. So that's just something to keep in mind. If you're someone that looks at these poems and you wonder why the tone is so, I guess, like, different between the two, or the subject matter is so different between the two, it's because we're not all suffering, you know? We're also people that have things that we care about and that we think about. But I'll digress off this point, so let's look at another poem. So this one is by Johnny Mahaffey. I might be mispronouncing this last name, but it's called It's Nothing I Haven't Said. And it goes as such. I knew this would occur. I told so in my letters. I would be convicted, I said. With no real lawyer, I was. At the mercy of a court. Without mercy. It would be of no appeal, I said. My hope, a PCR, post-conviction relief hearing. It would take 6 years, I said. It took that to the day, almost. Now, soon, I may be on my way. Free. I had a life, then no life. Now, a life once again. But what life? Truth is always found. It has a way, I said. It found that way, a way to get me home. A way I knew all along. Now I smell the pizzas the children and I will make. They can come to their daddy's door, the one I said I'd make. My past may attempt to haunt me, but taunt me I will not allow. Even now this prison attempts to hinder me in every way it can, holding back my mail between the bars they fear. Truth, an enemy of the wrongful, the facts they fear that will reveal their acts. Constitution set aside, they plot. As I've always said, in the end, trust always wins. I and others have said, Those immoral are themselves set aside, making way for better kind. Kind such as I that will go on to a better life, raise what life my kids have left, all grown up from their daddy's loss. Grandkids one day to run my house, to see our family store supply a town, to work their way lightly, playing along the days. All this will come to pass because it is the truth, I say. Now, this poem is really interesting for a couple of reasons to me. So the first reason is it shows the resilience of someone who was, at least according to him, falsely accused and convicted. So whether or not this is true, we can at least take it as true when looking at the meaning of what he was talking about, given that there isn't much value to the other option, right? There isn't much value to assuming that he was lying about this and then saying, oh, the whole poem is just a lie. Really nothing interesting to be gained from that. So again, let's take this as him telling the truth. So from the perspective of someone wrongfully imprisoned, it's interesting to see that there doesn't seem to be too much anger or bitterness involved, you know? Not that those would be wrong reactions to the situation, just different. It's a contrast from the experience of Carlos Brown, who felt like he was being used as a plaything for a system that aimed to punish him instead of reforming him. Now, Mahaffey doesn't absolve the system of its sin or anything, but he takes a much calmer approach, you know? He looks at his kids, his future grandkids, at what things would look like once he got out. You know, 6 years, it's mentioned in there, you know, 6 years for him to get a post-conviction release hearing, or relief hearing, and it may seem like a lot of time, but it's kind of nonchalantly dropped in there, you know? It's not repeated, like, he doesn't say, like, 6 years, 6 years I did this, and 6 years I did that. It's just kind of dropped in there as, like, well, you know, 6 years, but I've got, you know, bigger plans once I'm released. And I think that's pretty interesting as well, you know, and perhaps from that we can glean insight on how time seems to pass by differently in situations of stress for different people. You know, for me personally, and probably for a lot of people, you might believe that if you were falsely imprisoned, time would pass by slowly as you agonize over every moment knowing that you shouldn't be in there. But Mahaffey seems to have felt the opposite during his time on the inside, and perhaps that's because of how strongly he focuses on and expresses his wishes for the future in particular. You know, he looks at his wishes for the future in terms of opening a pizzeria, you know, fulfilling the promises he made to his kids and his future grandkids. And he has a firm belief in the truth overcoming his enemies inevitably. As truth is, in his words, the enemy of the wrongful. It will, quote, reveal their acts and plots, and it'll set the immoral aside, leading to his salvation from his situation. And thus you can see how different people react to the same situation in very different ways as well. And this is a super obvious thing, if I say it right. Like, I know how obvious this seems. Of course it makes sense that different people react differently, and of course it makes sense that different people will also react similarly to the same situation, you know, or whatever. This isn't really groundbreaking stuff. But to really feel what that means is a whole other thing. And that's what poetry is really good at getting to. It's not about the what, you know, it's not about the knowledge of the situation or anything. It's about the feeling of it all. It's about what it feels like to be incarcerated, you know. Does it feel like you're being whored out and pimped? Does it feel like the truth is eventually going to set you free? And those are all big questions that can't really be answered by someone who hasn't felt, you know, the whole ordeal, which is me, which is why I try to read these things off here. The other reason that I found this piece in particular interesting is that this poem was publicly posted and actually had a public response to it from the mother of Mahaffey's children. If you're interested in it, you can go to the website for Between the Bars, which is the organization / website that I got these poems from, and you can look for the poem It's Nothing I Haven't Said. It's always easy to think of everyone as a protagonist, but remember that everyone is a protagonist of their own stories. You know, there's a lot more to people's actual stories than just what they paint themselves as. I'm not going to say if anyone's particularly right or not, because I obviously don't know the full situation, but it's always something to consider. So in her reply to the poem, and again, remember we're talking about the mother of Mahaffey's children who replied to this, she expressed hope that he would be free to carry out his ambitions and become a good father, but also reminded him of things that he did wrong and which make her wonder if he would be true to his word. She asks him if it's true that he was falsely accused, you know, hoping that he was telling the truth about this, Henry responds in turn by affirming that it's true when he replied back to her, and he said that he's focused on making right his wrongs, you know, without holding grudges or anything. In his words, "I have a lot of work ahead of me. I won't be looking behind me, only forward." And so I just think it's really interesting to see that in this one you actually do have a reply from someone that would directly know him and was directly affected by him. You know, it's someone that can say, like, no, you're not perfect, or no, you were right, or no, you're completely wrong, or, you know, just any kind of response to give us some indication of what other people see him as. And I think it's interesting to see that she specifically says that she has no ill will to him, or anything, and that she does hope that he gets out and is able to make, you know, make good on his promises and everything. But at the same time, she does say that, you know, not everything is forgiven. And I think that's a pretty important aspect to this that wasn't in the poem as well. And again, it's not like because he excluded or anything, but it's just you get more perspectives added on as you get more replies and more engagement to this kind of poetry, to these kind of expressions. And so what you get added with that is, well, you get added, well, what if even if you are innocent, it's not like when you get out, everything is going to be good. Or let's say you're guilty and you've served your sentence. It's not like when you get out, everything's going to be good in terms of your relationships, whether that's with your kids, with your previous loved ones, or anything. Those are things that you are going to need to make a lot of effort to repair, whether or not you should have to do so or not. And so with that said, that'll be the show for today. We saw something today that we all knew, but we're able to get more into the feel rather than the know. Remember, we knew that these things would feel bad, but to really feel them ourselves, I think it's best to kind of just look at the poems, look at the words that incarcerated people had written themselves here, and, you know, see how that makes you feel. Remember that we aren't trying to judge if anyone is actually telling the truth or not, but rather just to see what their feelings look like, you know, to feel their feelings in a way. You know, try to look at how they are expressing themselves given the limited options available to them. And I'll leave it to you at that point to spend some time thinking not of whether someone deserves to be incarcerated or not, not of whether they're telling the truth or not, but just about how it feels to be them. You know, make any assumptions that you want. Assume they're guilty, assume they're innocent, assume anything that you want. But for this purpose, try to understand the feeling of what it's like to be them, instead of judging them for what they might have done. So if you think that they're guilty, think of how someone who's guilty might feel in that scenario, you know? If you think they're innocent, think of how an innocent person might feel in their scenario. I think that there's value to doing this, you know, given like whatever the reality of their situation is, because you'll probably find a lot of similarities between those two scenarios. You know, whether you're guilty or innocent, you know, being in that situation would make you feel a certain way. And I think it's powerful to understand these things, along with any differences that might pop up, and whether or not the differences in how the situation makes you feel is justified or not. And so with that said, I'll talk to you next time when we look more at the ideas behind prison poetry in general. I'll see you next time.